We've been studying together the concept of tshuva, the idea of spiritual, personal growth, and how a person can damage their own inner being, let's say. Also the cosmic structure in spiritual terms. And we've been studying here specifically the Rambam's explication of how you can undo things you did in the past. Between you and the overall structure, between you and another human being, but what's involved in that correcting breakdown that a person has caused in relationships and in their own inner purity, their own inner being, in whatever sense. We got up to the stage where the Rambam began to discuss spiritual accounting, in other words, the fact that a person is a balance at any one time. I mean, the time this is most clearly expressed in the mystical writing is when a person dies, because then there's no more changing that accounting. But at any one time, a person is really a balance of the the increase that they've made in the raw material they were born with. Right? That means you were born with a certain amount of raw material potential, as we discussed many times together in human terms. The looks you were born with, your intelligence, all the advantages and disadvantages of your family, background, the country you were born in, all those things are a constellation of factors that you can use to achieve greatness, or to bring out all your potential. So what happens is, at any one point in your life, you are actually a balance or a composite of what you've done with the raw material. That means how much effort you've put in to build yourself up, and all the damage you've done that's torn away from you the potential to develop. Right? Are you with me? For example, if you want a crude analogy, it would be if a person wants to be healthy, or let's say a person wants to build a strong body, wants to build muscle, let's say. I'm not recommending it. But let's say a person would want to do such a thing, then the hours that they put in of building muscle, right, which means the work they put in is only against resistance, you would see it reflected in size of muscle. But all the damage they've done to themselves, which takes place in two different dimensions, we discussed this before, the damage would be any damage they did to their body from outside, or bad nutrition, or even just wasted time. That means, even if they just wasted time, even if they didn't damage themselves, but they came to a competition, let's say you go to a competition where you have to show off your muscles, let's say, they have such things, by the way. Even the real gorillas don't do that. Anyway, let's say you would go to such a competition, and you'd regret two things. One thing you'd regret would be the damage that you did to your physique, right? But the other thing you'd regret is not damage that you did, but just time you wasted. Every hour in the gym that you could have worked harder, or every extra hour in the gym you could have put in, you'd regret now, right, as a sin of omission, because it would have resulted in more development. So spiritually it's exactly the same thing. There are two kinds of things to regret. One is the damage that a person did to himself, took some of his potential, had achieved or hadn't achieved, and damaged that potential, right? Actually harmed himself, let's say went contrary to his own principles. Person put forward certain principles in the world, never mind Torah values. As we've discussed before, some of the more severe accounting in the next world is on things that you yourself set up as values, never mind what Hashem demanded from you. But you yourself had certain, ascribed to certain values, loyalty, or being true to your word, being consistent, whatever it was, and you yourself perverted those values at times. So that is a damage. Now, that's a weakening of your own spiritual level. But then there's another damage, and that is the fact that you spent so many days, weeks, months, years in most cases it amounts to pretty much most of a lifetime, of not actually working on yourself. So when a person realizes that there's no more time left, then that comes much sooner than anybody expects. That time comes when a person would give anything for just one more day, or even an hour they'd give anything for, and they don't have an hour left. Then a person has a very, very sharp and bitter sense of the fact that a whole lifetime just went by and you actually didn't do any work on yourself at all. Right? The person then becomes aware, it says in the transition, that you're not going to get credit for the things you achieved that came without effort. As we discussed many times before, who's here for the first time tonight? You're not given any credit for the things that were natural gifts. The only thing you're given credit for, I mean, again, it's not credit, as we've tried to explain before, it's just you. There's no reward. You know, there's no reward in the spiritual world or in the next world or in the own inner being. There's no reward. The reward, what we call reward, there's no English word for it, but the reward is simply the experience of who you are. When a person faces with clarity who they are, so there's no happier experience in the world than facing somebody that you built yourself into. Now, that is the achievement. And the happiness of it is that you did that. The sadness is facing yourself and realizing that you didn't do it and you had the opportunity to do it. As I explained to you once before, there's a chazal that says that the resistance that stands in your way is only yourself. That there's no resistance external to you. Although in the mystical writings it says there is. But generally speaking, the resistance to your own development is your own personality. Right? Your own negativity, your willful negativity. Your own laziness, your own physicality, whatever. Emotional level, physical level. Those were impediments to your own growth. So it says in the next world, a person is shown his own force of negativity. That means they show him, they show you your own personality, and they show you where it brought you down. So it says clearly a wonderful statement. I mean, it's brought in the mystical sphere, but of course you don't need much sensitivity, just a little sensitivity to understand what it's saying, is that when a person comes face to face with his own lower self, with his own negative force, the force that kept him denying any transcendent reality or any higher meaning or whatever it was, so then two groups of people fall into two categories. They see it in opposite ways. The Rosha says, or let's say the tzaddik, person tzaddik means someone who fulfilled his obligations. That means somebody who developed himself to the maximum. A tzaddik sees his own negativity as an insurmountable mountain. That's what it says. Sees his own yetzer hara, that means his own force of negativity, as a tremendous mountain. And he exclaims in amazement, how did I overcome that? How was I able to overcome such an enormous mountain? The Rosha, that means the person who never lived up to his obligations, who spent his life not developing himself. So then they show him his own negativity, and it's only as one hair's breadth thin. And he exclaims, how is it that I wasn't able to conquer something as thin as one hair's breadth? But that's what it means, of course. It means that the negativity is as great as you are, and it takes all you have to overcome it. But you're always within a hair's breadth reach of overcoming it, because it would never be an ordeal, as we've discussed on other occasions, it would never be an ordeal for you if it were pitched at a level that you couldn't overcome. An ordeal is always one hair's breadth more than you can just make now. So what happens is you have to strain to that new level, conquer at that new level, then hold at the new level. And that's how you grow. And the next time the ordeal will be greater. Just like a person picking up weights has to pick up heavier each time, right? And then he builds to a new level, and that's how it goes. But of course, each time he wants to develop, he has to pick up a new weight that he never picked up before. And then he has to hold at that level, and that's how it goes. Now, that's the background, and that's what it means, the context of spiritual accounting. Again, we want to get out of our head the childhood, or Western secular, or Christian, Christological version of these things. It's not that a person goes to a place in the end where there's a judgment, as we tried to describe in detail last week. It's all phrased in those terms, but it's only because we don't have the sensitivity, the words, to say the thing as it actually is. So we use only an analogy so that the sensitive mind can link up to the abstract core. But what it means is not that you are in judgment, you don't stand in a courtroom, but it means you come face to face with your own reality. Actually, people who are sensitive are facing that all the time. You don't have to wait till the next world. The pain is that the next world, you're forced into it. Because in the next world, you're stripped away from the shield, the mask dimension, the emotional level and the physical level is stripped away from you. Yeah, you're forced to come face to face with it. But people who can strip themselves that way in this world of all their vectored interests, so they can face their own, they're in tune with their own reality all the time. And that's what a person's striving for, actually to live in the next world here, or to live in a messianic phase here. There's a wonderful story about a great Hasidic Rebbe who lived in Tzfat. Tzfat, great Hasidic Rebbe of Mendel, his name was. They say that one day his wife came home, this must have been in the early days, must have been 200 years ago when the Hasidim moved to Tzfat. His wife came home one day and said to him, Reb Mendel, they're saying that the Mashiach has arrived. That means in the townspeople in town, Tzfat, she'd been in the market, people had said that the Mashiach had arrived and he was on his way. Not imminent. So she told her husband, Reb Mendel, they say that the Mashiach is here. So he went to the window and he put his head out for a few seconds, and he said to her, no, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. He's not here. The Hasidim asked on that story, why did he have to put his head out the window? Well, what was out the window that wasn't inside? What? You follow? There's nothing accidental in this thing. Why did he have to put his head? You know, if you had to sense the air, that was the idea. So the air in here, there's air out there. You follow the question. If you hear the problem, you're not going to enjoy the answer unless you hear the problem. It's a deep story. What did he have to put his head out the window for? If he was intuiting the state of the world so he could feel the vibes wherever he was. No. So Hasidim answered like this. He had to put his head out the window because by him in Shtub, that means where he was in his Dalad Amos, in the confines of his environment, it already was messianic phase. That means there was no way he could tell the difference over there. That means his ambience, what he'd exuded, his own spiritual depth that he'd already raised himself to, he was living already in that phase. So in his own environment, his own immediate environment, he wasn't going to be able to feel the change. They're beautiful. He had to go out into the outer reality, and that hadn't changed. But that's what a person has to live himself. Often we describe this, that a person who wants to live a Torah way of life has to live upside down. You have to live in such a way that you look silly. You have to look funny in this world. I mean, we don't deliberately try and look funny, but often you do look funny. And that's because actually we're the right way up. When you try and tell them that, they laugh even harder. But it's fine, because when they turn inside out, it will hurt badly. Unfortunately, we're also going to be turned inside out. No matter how hard you try, it's very hard not to be influenced by the secular values. And that's how it is. No matter how silly you think it is, when you walk past the gorilla, then you are tempted to kind of, you do kind of... you're going to sometimes get, you know, some of that feeling. When that isn't important at all, but you are influenced and affected by that. Of course, the key to this idea is the women. Right? That's the key. Right? Because as long as they admire the gorillas, then these chaps are going to still try and look like that. But when the women start admiring something that's more sensitive, then men will become more sensitive. That's another story. But now, you are supposed to ask questions. I'm just ad-libbing until you ask questions. If you're supposed to ask questions on a Sunday night, and if I'm able to, then I'll try and answer. So far, any question?
No.
Yes, please. Are you going to ask related to what we said, Tony? On the immediate topic. We're discussing judgment and levels of spiritual balance so far. If it's not that, can you hold it for now? Okay. Anything else on this immediate topic? Yes, please. Sensitive gorilla. That's actually a serious question. That's a serious question. And there is such a thing. And the Rambam says actually you should develop a healthy body. It's very important, and it is an end that one should seek out, definitely. What we're trying to insult over here very pointedly is somebody who makes that the ikka. That's a very serious question. I'll just tell you briefly the concept is like this. That, and by the way, I'll tell you a paradox. That it doesn't matter how extreme. That means if a person would do it, right, would develop his body to an extreme, but it would never become the main thing. It would only be a vehicle for who he is. It would be okay. You'd have to think of why it want, you know, to get to an extreme, because that would take the kind of time and effort that probably would detract from the essential level. But theoretically, you follow what I'm getting at. The idea spiritually is like this. This is a very, very, very deep idea. And it's as follows. That you have in the world what they call the right and the left hand. The right and the left hand is a very deep mystical concept, but its application in the world is this. That you have what's called... Let me ask you a question. You know that we understand that the physical world is a manifestation of the spiritual world. There are very few people here who haven't been here before. So everybody's been here before. Most of you should know already that the whole structure of the physical universe is just a reflection of the spiritual world. We've discussed that many times. Which means if you understand anything correctly in the physical world, then you understand something very deep in the spiritual. The obvious example in tonight's discussion would be if it's possible to develop the body, and only against resistance and it takes work, that must be an indication that the neshama, the spiritual equivalent, is exactly the same. That if you stress it against ordeal, and against adversity, so then it will grow. If trained correctly, with the right food, has to be fed Torah and mitzvahs, it has to be trained in the right way, you mustn't overstrain it, you can't go too far. Exactly, the analogy will be exactly the same. It has to be that way. If that's true, how come there's a right and a left hand? Why, I don't mean why is there a bilateral symmetry, why do we have right and left side, that's another deep question that relates to male and female, but why is it that there's a thing called handedness? Why is there a dominant side and a non-dominant side? What's the message in that? Why wasn't a person, right, born in such a way that you are equally able to use both sides. What is it about the spiritual world that makes one side dominant? And by the way, it's a very, very deep secret that the world is actually sensitive to. You know that in many languages, the word for right, even, is actually a positive word, and the word for left is a negative word. You're aware of that. Even in English, right and right are the same word. In Latin, dexter, the right side, means dexterous or able, and left, sinister, means sinister. In Hebrew, of course, which is the source of all this, it's even more potent, is that the right hand is a word in Hebrew that always means positivity, the right side, and the left, small, I don't even want to say the word, the word for left in Hebrew, if you spell it out, it spells the angel, it spells out, right, the Samach Mem, which is the spiritual force of tremendous destruction in the world. That means that there's something intrinsic about the right side or the dominant side, being if you're left-handed, it's not a problem, okay? So I know that's the next question, but the dominant side is a concept of spiritual positivity, and the left side is a thing of negativity. Now, why is that? Why do you have that construction in the world? What's the message? So the mystics say, you'll see, I know you're not with me yet, but you'll see where I'm going, okay? I'm going to come back to your question. The mystics say this, that's to teach you, to show you, right, it's a manifestation of the fact that in the world you have a thing called Ikka and a thing called Tophel. Ikka means the prime thing itself, and Tophel means the subservient aspect of the thing. Right? For example, and the whole world fits into that, you might not have ever thought about the world that way, but a little examination will show you that everything in the world fits into that category. For example, a person and his vehicle. A person and his vehicle. So the person is the main thing, and the vehicle is secondary. That means it's justified insofar as it gets you where you need to go. But to make an end of it in its own right is pointless. The fact that most of the world does that, right, and they actually adorn the thing, right, and spend time and effort and money on it as if it was something, right, that they serve, right, that's the epitome of evil in the world. That's the most brainless attitude to the world that it could be. But the world is what's called a merkava. It means a chariot. It means something on which the main thing rides. Again, let's understand. You've got two levels to everything. That which carries and that which is carried. That which is carried goes through the world and gets to where it has to go because it has a vehicle carrying it. Obviously, the important thing is the thing inside that gets where it has to go and do what it has to do. But it can't get there unless the vehicle functions, unless the vehicle does what it's supposed to do and is efficient and functions as a vehicle. Are you with me? If that's what happens, so then you have a fantastic and perfect balance in the world. What happens then is that the vehicle reaches perfection because it's doing the job it's supposed to do, and together they earn the credit that they do the job. When the vehicle takes over and wants to go where it wants to go, in other words, when the vehicle becomes an end in itself, that's what's called evil. You follow? Then the ikka, the real thing, gets schlepped along where the thing that's supposed to be a servant, you follow? Where the master, who's supposed to be directing. We once discussed this in great depth, which is the concept, again, it'll take too long to discuss this fully, but just for those who are with us and those who are thinking more, you'll see we once discussed this in the mind as what's called intellect and imagination. The intellect is the pattern and the directive in the mind. Imagination is the vehicle that throws up the images that the intellect needs. Are you with me? If you like, the intellect, what we call seichel, is like the computer program. The imagination, what's called dimyon, is like the symbols that you put into the computer. Or another way would be, the intellect would be like the hardware, the computer, and the dimyon would be all the software that you put in, without which, you know, the pathways are all there, the logical capability is there, but unless you put in the facts, the symbols, the facts, the images, so the program can't run. The mind's like that too. You have a naked logic, that means an ability to reason, ability to of directed thinking, but every pathway of directed thinking works only with specifics. Numbers, symbols, images, memories, people, whatever the variables are, the imagination provides those. It's clear, are you with me? In your imagination bank, right, you have the physical side of your thinking. Images, memories, pictures, diagrams, words, all the finite details. In your intellect bank, which is the control dimension, you have the ability to manipulate these things logically. Are you with me? The mystics call that the male dimension, and the imagination bank, the rich bank of imagery, the female side. What happens is you need a perfect marriage. When the seichel, the intellect dimension, controls the dimyon dimension in such a way that she only throws up the images that are relevant and useful at that time, so then the program functions perfectly. You follow? Because the intellect can direct the imagination, right, to where it needs to go, but only if she only gives him what he needs. If she gives him extraneous information, the whole program will blow. What do you have? You have the thing that's riding, that's the intellect, and the thing which is ridden, which is the imagination. The main, of course, you can only get where you're going where they both function together. If the imagination takes over, are you with me? The cycle can't function on its own. A logical pathway without anything to work on is a computer without a program just is nothing. But the image bank, the memories, right? All the information, the data you can feed into a process in a computer without the program, also nothing. The one carries the other. When that gets carried away by itself, the whole thing goes out of confunction. When the imagination starts becoming powerful and starts feeding into the mind, images and pictures and memories and data that you don't need, and of course, which is the more powerful one? Always the lower one. The one that's ridden, not lower, the one's ridden. The female dimension is always the more powerful dimension. Sorry, Dad, to tell you that. But it's the female dimension that's more powerful. She's the one who has all the punch, all the potency. And you can see it easily. In the mind, you see that what happens is the seichel is a very tenuous business. It takes a lot of energy to keep it working. If you want to think logically from one step to the next, you have to drive your mind very hard. It takes a lot of effort, of concentration. But when the imagination works, it takes no effort at all. She is self-fueled. You follow? The imagination has tremendous amount of energy of her own. I mean, the only proof you need is when you try to concentrate on something for 1 minute at a time, you will soon see that what happens is you might get through one step or two steps if you're lucky, and then what happens is the imagination throws up some unassociated image. In other words, it's just associated by some peripheral detail, and that flings you onto the next thing, and before you know it, right? The usual experience, as we've often said, is when you're trying to daven a good Shemona Esrei. Right? You're standing now, the minion's about to start davening, you take 3 steps back, and boy, you're really going to speak to Hashem. What happens about 3 seconds later, you're in Hong Kong, right? if you're lucky, usually it's much worse than that. And what happens is, what happened? You started with concentration, you meant what you said, but then some peripheral detail triggered an association. Completely irrelevant logically, but because it's so powerful, the links, okay? And then that image or memory or whatever triggered something else, and before you know it, there's not, and sometimes it's embarrassing, you can't even figure out how you got there. You don't even know what, have you ever had that? And that doesn't take any effort. You sit back in an easy chair, the intellect doesn't work. Imagination works. That's how it is. Now. So you see, you have the vehicle which is powerful, like a man and his vehicle that he drives. The vehicle is much more powerful than he is. He's just a very fragile and weak creature who directs all that enormous power. But if the control dimension is correctly done, so then the vehicle takes in, they both get what they have to, and they both reach perfection. But when the vehicle gets out of hand, and then you have destruction. Now, what they call the directing dimension is the right hand, and the subservient dimension, the one that functions in tandem and only supports it, is called the left hand. When the left hand tries to be the main one, then you can't do the job properly. When the left assists the right hand, you can do a perfect job. You follow? But if you try and do the job with the left hand, you wouldn't like it if you needed a brain operation, and the surgeon decided that day to try with his left hand just to see how things are going, and he let his right hand assist. It wouldn't be so good, right? Because when the left assists, then you have a perfect unit. The whole world's like that. The body, we understand, is the vehicle for who you are. You mean, inside that body is somebody that's supposed to be sensitive. That's you. When the body carries you around as a vehicle, so then it's justified to pour a lot of energy into the body. It should be clean, should be healthy, should be developed, right? It can't be a vehicle. If the vehicle you drive to get where you have to go is faulty, if you don't put energy into it and keep it functioning, so you're not going to get where you have to go. And everything fails. The vehicle's not a vehicle and you're not what you're supposed to be. So what you need is, you need the body developed, this is your question, you need the body developed, but only such that every detail of development in the body is only to be a vehicle for who you are. And the reason's obvious. Because when the end of your life comes, so the body definitely disappears. What happens to the mind is debatable. We believe that it keeps going. But if you're a non-believer, so it's debatable. But the body, for sure, we know what happens to that. That for sure doesn't remain. So at best, that could be a vehicle. It might be everything if you're a non-believer. But it's at best a vehicle. So to pour energy into something that's at best a vehicle and make it the main thing is obviously futile. You follow? That's how we look at this problem logically. And therefore, yes, there is such a thing. A person could be very well developed physically, whatever that means, but never to the extent that it takes over and becomes something in its own right. Are you following me? There might be some extremes. Maybe somebody makes a living from it, let's say. I'm just trying to think of an extreme. Somebody makes a living out of sport, maybe. So he makes a living out of it. So it's justified to put in as much effort, much more than just for the sake of the thing, because it's actually his living as well. Then it's another debate how much effort one should put into making a living. Okay, but nevertheless, that would justify it more. Or he's got some particular role in life or occupation where his vehicle needs to be even more developed than somebody else's. But when it, you follow me, when it becomes an ikkar, when that becomes what you're here for, and you become secondary, so then it's a car driving a man around to no place that he wants to go, and he's just out of control. But it's obviously futile. And if you think this analogy through, you'll see it applies to everything. It's actually very deep idea. Are there any questions on that subject? That's the ideal. The practical application is that we live in a society that's got the whole thing upside down from the start. Our society worships the external. It has a whole philosophy that the external is everything. Right? It doesn't just reverse the issue, it completely denies the internal dimension. It teaches you that you are only a gorilla. The internal dimension is just an accidental control thing that happened to evolve by accident, etc., etc. No meaning to it. So therefore, the society, you know, that discussion doesn't even begin. Therefore, build the external, and of course it's a very sad world, because there's a limit to what you can build in the external, and definitely you see that it starts to fade. The more control you gain over it, the more extreme you bring it to its development, the closer you realize you are to when it's going to finally be running down. So the non-Jewish, the secular, non-spiritual view of the world is necessarily a very sad view of the world, because the more pleasure you can eke out of it, the more you become aware, if you're sensitive, of your own mortality. So there are only two solutions, is to choose the spiritual path or to be very insensitive, which is what most of the world is. Just ignore the fact and eventually end up in, you know, tremendous misery. Our view of the world is not like this. Our view of the world is that you're building an inner reality all the time. We don't mind when the vehicle starts to fade out because it's taken you where you have to go. That's why in Jewish terms, old age is always called summer. In the secular literature that I've ever seen, I'm not the world expert in the world's literature, but in any language I've ever seen or seen in translation, the literature of that culture always describes youth as spring and summer and old age as winter. And in Torah you'll always see that youth is described as winter and old age as summer. Because in youth is the winter when nothing's grown. And they're breaking the hard ground to put the seeds in, but you don't have anything yet. But old age is when the summertime, the crop is there to be reaped. The very great happiness. A Jew's happiness increases as he gets older, when he's bought the goods, when he's spending his life energy to buy the real goods. A very happy view of life. But only when you keep the proportion between the right and the left hand intact. By the way, this is Mitzvah Hashem next Monday night. I think next Monday night. We'd like to have a discussion about the problems of the Baal Teshuva. You know, people getting involved in becoming more religious and the conflicts they have with everybody else. Especially their family, but usually everybody. We'd like to have a discussion about that, especially for the people who are on the receiving end. Right? Not only the Baal Teshuva, we want to advertise it to other families who are being driven crazy by the people getting involved, so they'll come also. So there we'll try and show that one of the problems the Baal Teshuva has is that he exchanges the... he runs into this conflict. In other words, you know, the religious view of life is to put the emphasis on the spiritual dimension and the body is completely secondary. But that leads to an extreme where people start denying the body. When they start trying to subdue the body by painful means in order that it shouldn't dampen the spiritual core. And what happens is you often get out of balance. And you can often get very much out of balance. They don't want to experience the body, they don't want to experience pleasure from the body because they feel that that is against the spiritual reality. And therefore you've got to damp down and subdue the body. I mentioned to you once, I walked into the canteen once in Osama Yeshiva, Jerusalem, and I saw someone, a new American chap, been there for about a week, and he was eating his lunch and he looked very sick. It was a very distinct color, green. So I walked over to him and I said, "Listen, are you feeling okay? What's the problem?" He said, "No, it's okay. He's just eating his lunch. He's swallowing his food without chewing it because he doesn't want to get any pleasure from the world." Okay? So that explained to him that that's not the path to spiritual perfection. You know, that's not the way to do it. But the problem is that in the spiritual writings, in the Musa writings, you will see a thing called precious. Precious means to leave the body, to damp down the body and to not emphasize, to de-emphasize the body. On the other hand, you see that Judaism is a religion that very much emphasizes the body. We always connect to the body. We get married. The non-Jewish conception of spirituality is to leave the body behind. They live in a cave, they don't get married, they don't touch alcohol, right? They become completely divorced from physicality in order to reach the spiritual world. There is such a pathway that might be valid for certain of the non-Jewish things. That's another discussion. But the Jewish pathway is to descend into the physical and use it as a vehicle to raise yourself. And that's why we get married. We're supposed to engage in every single physical activity. We drink wine. Dafka, we drink wine. At every moment of spirituality, we drink wine, which is the capability of making you very much part of the physical. That's our symbol of how we use the physical to elevate ourselves. Wine has that duality, and that's how we use it that way. And that's why. So what's the answer? What's the answer to this conflict? If you're supposed to damp down the body, how come we use it so much? But from what we've discussed this evening, it should be obvious. And that is that using the body as an end in itself is evil. That's what you're not allowed to do. To derive pleasure from the body just for the sake of the pleasure, that's a Jew's never allowed to do. That's a waste of time. But to derive pleasure from the body for a spiritual uplift, that means that you could focus on what you're supposed to be doing in the world. So they're not only keeping the body healthy, but even pleasure from the body is a spiritual activity. Right? And therefore we do that very much. But only when it remains a vehicle for who you are. When the body takes over, as that's precious means keeping away from the body as an end in itself. That you're never allowed to do. To eat just for the sake of eating because it feels good, it's not forbidden by the Torah, but it's a very negative activity. Even animals don't do that. But to eat because you need the sustenance and the pleasure to keep going. Right, and to function and to build yourself and build the world and your relationships and your family and so forth. So that's definitely a spiritual activity. So you transform the food into spiritual energy. That's fantastic. And for that you should eat well and healthily. But to eat for the sake of it or to derive pleasure from the body only for the sake of the body, that's never justified. That's clear. Is it clear? Yes, please. No, it would be essential. It would be essential. If you're making a living out of having that image, yeah. If it's connected with how efficiently you function, so then you must have the image too. The only thing is, the more you have to be... Are you with me? That means, you have a car, let's say, okay, that's specifically expensive, and you buy it because it's expensive, or the company does, because you need that image to sell what you're selling. Provided you're not breaking any halachas here. There are limits to what you can do in order to sell this. There's halachic limits about how you can advertise a product and how much profit you can make and how much you can paint it up to look better than it is. It's all governed by halacha. Right? You're not allowed to breach the line of dishonesty. But that's another question. But provided it all fits into that, you need a successful image. Right? And it says that in halacha, it says that chokhmas hamiska in bezuya, the wisdom of a poverty-stricken individual is spurned, scorned. Nobody wants to take from you or buy from you or learn from you if you are poverty-stricken and unsuccessful. Even though you may be saying the same as the next man who happens to look successful. They'll listen to him, they won't listen to you. That's a fact in the world. And therefore, that kind of physical exterior and the way you dress, right, and the way your wife dresses and the kind of home you live in, those could be essential to your thing. The only problem is when you're choosing in life what it is that you should be doing, what you should be selling, what company you should be working for, and so forth. You have to remember that it's much harder to remain spiritually sensitive when you are engaging in that kind of activity, because the physical exterior attracts you until it blinds you from remembering that it's only a vehicle. Do you follow? It has such a pull on you that the physical dimension is much more attractive and speaks much more powerfully to the gut level, to what makes you tick, than does the spiritual refinement that you've got to work on all the time. Always, like I said before, it's the one closer to the real world, the woman's world, that's always much more powerful. That's what gives life to the world. And it's much more powerful. The control dimension, the program dimension, if you like, the pure, rare intellect dimension is very weak. Only energy that it has comes from her. A man is only what his wife makes him. You know that. But that's much harder. Therefore, you should choose in life a course that isn't going to be dangerous. The Bala Musa say that a thick wallet is a wall between you and Hashem. Because it makes you think, yes, that you're riding on your own steam now. But a poverty-stricken individual is much closer to Emunah, because he feels much more acutely his situation in the world. So you have to be very careful. The second danger is that you tend to overdo it. What happens is that usually that pathway is just rationalization. I need this and this and this image in order to sell this and this and this and this. But it's actually rationalization because you actually like doing it. So you have to be very, very honest with yourself. Sometimes you may have to do it despite this problem, because objectively it is right. And then there's other dangers also. I once mentioned before, and I'll mention it again, that Jews should always have a low profile in society anyway. There are other reasons, apart from what we're discussing now, for not having a fancy vehicle and exterior. Because it only fuels the fires of the feeling against us. Nobody objects to Jews who are engaged in spirit. No goy ever objected to a Jew sitting in a base medrash learning all day. Doesn't bother him in the least. A Jew sits in a black coat and a suit, whatever it is, and he has a beard, and he sits in the base medrash learning dusty old volumes of the Talmud, The goy doesn't object to that at all. It doesn't bother him. On the contrary, respects that. Respects that. But when the Jew starts doing better than he does at what he's supposed to be doing, the non-Jewish nations are supposed to be building the physical world. That's their spiritual tachlis in the world. We're supposed to be, that's the relationship we're supposed to have with them, husband and wife. It's supposed to be that way. When he sees you doing better what he thinks he should be doing, and you're taking away the wherewithal that he thinks he should have, and he'll think that even if it's not justified. So then he gets very, very upset and very resentful, and Jews make themselves out as a target in the world. And therefore you have to be very, very careful. Even if you need a successful image, so it doesn't have to be pink with purple spots on it. You know, it can be, you follow, it can be expensive, let's say, but it should be tasteful, muted. I mean, you can have nice inside, but outside should be, and a person has to function with a little bit of seichel. Because we're definitely going to be the first ones to be blamed whichever way things go. You know that, right here. For sure. Yeah. Any other questions on this? A Jew should have a high profile in being balanced, commonsensical, kindly, giving, gentle. That you can have a high profile. But a low political profile and a low financial type profile, definitely a Jew should have that. We discussed that before. All right, let's see the next level. Yeah. The Rambam says now as follows. With your permission, I'm going to leave out the next paragraph. The next paragraph is how a person can be closer to this kind of sensitivity in the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and how the shofar has an effect on the Jewish neshama that brings out the sensitivity. And it's not appropriate to this time of year specifically, so if you don't mind, I think we'll come back to that in a little time. Let's not look at that now. Let's just look at the next section that the Rambam talks about. It's very difficult. I'm just going to read you the words. This, to understand this fully, requires an in-depth study of this piece of the Talmud. The Gemara discusses this amazing concept of balance in the spiritual world in a way that makes these words seem very difficult to understand, but I'll read you the words you have to know. It says this, B'shah she'shoiklin avoinois Adam, at the time when they balance out the negative deeds that a person has done, right? Let's say you've hurt somebody, or you've missed an opportunity for your own growth, all the negative things you've done in the world, when that comes to be balanced, in other words, let's translate that into our terms, when that takes its effect on your personality, im schuyosav, when they balance it out with the positive things that you've done, listen to this, ein mechavshin olav, they do not calculate, avon shechata boy tchila, they don't count the first negative act that you did, beloy sheini, and not the second one, elam shlishi v'elach, only from the third one on. It's a very deep mystical idea that when a person has got a balance in the spiritual world of positive and negative actions, the way they do it is they take the first negative action and they discard it. The second and they discard it. From the third, they start weighing it up against positive actions. And they start making a balance. It means you get a two, what do you call it? A two-blow lead, your handicap, whatever it's called. You get a two-struck lead, right? That's what you get, okay, before they start ticking it off against you. It's a lengthy section in the Talmud. Im nimtzu avonoisav mishlishi v'eilach merubin al schoyosav, if all your negative actions, and again it's not number, we once explained before, it's the quality, it's not the specific number, it's how much damage you did to yourself. Obviously it's irrelevant, the number of deeds. You can do a few small things, right? It could be one thing that you did to yourself was a bigger disappointment to your own spiritual being than many small things. But if all the positive things, all the negative things that you did from the third one on are more than Suyoisab, than the merit that you built for yourself. Then they go back and they slip out the first two that they gave you credit for and they add them onto the pile. You don't get away with it. You hear that? Remarkable thing. First they give you a chance. They knock off the first one, they disregard it. What's the first? I don't know. What means the first? Doesn't that tell you the first one that you did? It might be in terms of priority, in terms of damage. I don't know. Okay, I'm not familiar enough with that piece of the Gemara. You have to study it together sometime. But they knock off the first one. Then they knock off the second. From the third on, they start balancing. If you end up on positive balance, then you have a positive balance. And not only that, but the first two never count again. If you end up negative, you've got to pay for everything. You follow me? If you like, it's a bit like when they send a man out with an expense account. So they don't mind what he spends on the expense account if in the end he returns a deal that's more than what they spent on him. Well, they're never going to call in the expense account, even if he stayed at the Hilton. Doesn't bother them. He had caviar every night. It doesn't matter what. But he made a deal that's bigger than that, and the profit he turns into for the company, that's no problem. But if he lived at the Hilton every night, and he really lived it up, and in the end he didn't make any deals, well, then they're going to take back from him what he cost the company. You follow? Which is why it's better to live cheaply, as the Chofetz Chaim says. that you should go through life as cheaply as possible because you're on an expense account over here. The more pleasure you take out, it's another reason not to have fancy goods, by the way. The more pleasure you take out of the world, so the more the goods you're supposed to deliver. Money, they sent you here for a purpose. So finally, when you turn in your accounting, if you brought home a few good deals, they won't mind the expenses that you think over here. But if you had a fantastic expense account over here, you know, cruises in the Caribbean and who knows whatever else it is, then for a lifetime, and you didn't bring in any goods in terms of personal development, so then you're a big expense, Tasha. And you have to pay for it. That's what it says. Yeah. Yeah.
What if one of the first two values is Chilul Hashem?
No, so I told you, I don't know what means first and second. We'll come to that later. There's some of errors that stack up much more powerfully against others. That is a subject we'll see now. This is all else being equal. Now, ואם נמצאו זכויות של כנגד אבוינויסב אשר מאבן שלישי ואילך מעבירים כל אבוינויסב ראשון ראשון. If you turn out to have more positive than negative, then they knock off each negativity against the positive, and in the end you have a clean slate, okay, all positive. לפי שהשלישי נחשב ראשון, because the third is considered the first, שכבר נמחל השניים, because the first two have been knocked off. וכן הרביעי, and the fourth one is called the first one, because they knock off. As long as you're in positive balance, each negative thing that comes up against the balance is nullified. So it's absolutely knocked off. Then they measure the fourth one, and that's considered the first. And if it's knocked off, it's knocked off, and it disappears. It's a fantastic thing. We explained once before, it's not a mechanical thing like this. It depends on where you plant yourself. You remember we once discussed, it depends on who you are intrinsically. You've got to go back to that discussion if you want to put this in context. But listen, let's just see how he puts it. V'chein ha-ravi rishon. Until they all finished. This only applies to an individual. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, just that let's hear the words. This applies only to an individual. And by the way, this isn't only necessarily Jews. The Rambam many times in this section talks about called Ba'ei Olam, all people who come into the world. Much of this spiritual accounting applies to Jews and non-Jews, although the spiritual balance for a Jew and a non-Jew is very, very different in the world, what we are supposed to do compared to what non-Jews are supposed to do. Just like men and women have got very different general roles, and just like no two men or two women have got the same role, but with regard to this subject of judgment and spiritual accounting, they are very similar. What are we talking about? The Yachid. Only when we're talking about an individual. Shenemar, Hein Kol Eile Yifol Kael. Palim Shalosh Im Gever. It's a pasuk that talks about this. Avalat Zibur, but if you're part of a Jewish community, 10 people or more, Tolinain Avon Rishon Shani Vishlishi, then you get credit for the first, second, and third. Shenemar Al Shlesha Pishei Yisrael Val Arbo Loi Ashibenu. I will not hold him accountable, them, the Jewish people, for three or for four. Which means that you have a tremendous benefit, right, of 25% discount, or whatever you call it, 33%, depends how you look at it. If you are part of a Jewish community, later the Rambam will speak about the damage of a person who separates himself from the rest of the Jewish people, even if he doesn't do anything wrong. Even if all he does is just function separately, right? Then, that's a tremendous negative. When this calculation is, now listen carefully here, when this calculation is made, the community is judged from the fourth one on. Now listen carefully. What happens when the community is judged? What happens when you get to those people who are part of the community, okay, who are not responsible for their counting? Listen carefully. You're part of the Jewish community. The community is being judged. We discussed before, and that's why the Rambam puts it here on Rosh Hashanah, you're judged as if the world depends on you, because you have to regard yourself as if you're exactly poised in the middle. We discussed in depth what that means. Then you're part of a larger group, the town you live in, as it happens. That also hangs in the balance, and therefore your falling into the positive side could turn the whole town onto the positive side. But then there's the country also, and then the country fits into all the countries in the world, which means, you follow, everything's teetering in the balance, and every group could tipple the balance to one side or the other. Now, you're part of a community. What happens when the community is judged? And what happens is the accounting comes out, but you personally were neutral. Okay? It means you didn't tip it one way or the other. You were neutral. Listen to this. Habayinanim, the intermediate type of individual, im haya bichlal nechza abayinah shelahen, if the half of what they did wrong, again, we're talking about a person who did theoretical half wrong and half right. Please remember, we're not talking about It's not arithmetic. It means a person who has not placed himself in one side or the other. A person who goes through life, when something positive comes to hand, he does it. When something negative comes to hand, he's got a vested interest, he does it also. Somebody hasn't made a decision, okay? He hasn't decided that he's only for himself in the world and he's an evil individual, that means he doesn't care about anything else. And somebody who hasn't decided that he's here to develop himself and to help and to contribute to the world. That's, if somebody just takes each day that comes without thinking about these things, that's called a Beinoni. Somebody who hasn't yet made a decision that he's here to do a job. That kind of person. Now, so he's stacked exactly evenly, right? He's got what we call 50% positivity, what we call, and 50% negativity. Now, listen to this. If there is included in his negative actions, shaloi hineach tfilin, that he never put on tfilin, my oilam, ever, danin oisoi kefi chetoi, then he falls on the negative side, he's judged according to his sin, v'yesh lechelik l'amaba, but he has a share in the next world. Okay, this is not one of the people who loses his share in the next world. To lose your share in the next world, you have to do things much worse than not put on tfilin. We will discuss that later, the kind of things that make a person lose his share in the next world. I need, those are positive mitzvahs. Negative mitzvahs are things you may not do, like steal, harm somebody physically or financially, insult people. Negative things, things you may not do. The punishment for negative mitzvahs is much more severe than for positive mitzvahs, even though positive mitzvahs are more important than negative mitzvahs. Not going to go into that again, we discussed it before. But, of the positive mitzvahs, the punishments are less. Which means it's very hard to earn for the omission of a positive mitzvah a punishment as severe as for... Are you with me? There's no positive mitzvah that if you omit it can get you as severe punishment as for chas v'shalom murdering somebody or stealing or hurting somebody. Not saying Shema, not putting on tefillin does not generate such a negative. There are two exceptions, and one is the Korban Pesach, eating, sacrificing and eating the Pesach sacrifice, which is not relevant to us today, only applies when the temple stands, and not being circumcised. Right? If you reach Bar Mitzvah, if it's not your fault, if you reach an age where you know about it, meaningfully and deliberately don't, right, have oneself circumcised, then for the omission of Bris Milah, those two blood mitzvahs, then a person can reach the level called chorus, which means excision of the neshama in the next world. Again, it doesn't mean complete excision. There's no such thing. It's something we have to discuss when we get to the subject of chorus. Those two mitzvahs. Not putting on tefillin does not get you as serious a punishment as any of those. Okay? Now, but, nevertheless, it is the single mitzvah that if you omit it, will cause this disastrous situation. The Rambam says, lo lam, that means he never put on tefillin. He does not. There's a discussion about this in the authorities, in the halachic, in the poskim. But the Rambam's opinion is it means somebody who never ever put on kosher tefillin, not somebody who doesn't do it regularly. You follow me? In other words, if you want to omit, if you want to avoid this problem, put on tefillin once at least. Not a bad idea to do it more, right? But at least once you have to do it. That means I would very strongly suggest you rush out tomorrow morning. Okay, if you've never done it before, at least get out of this category. Go out tomorrow morning, borrow a pair of kosher tefillin, make sure that they're kosher. Okay, it's a tremendous pity to spend the rest of your life and all of eternity with this problem hanging over your head because you borrowed unkosher tefillin. Borrow kosher tefillin if you don't have and put them on once properly. Okay, get someone to show you. If I were you, I'd do it a few times just to make sure you get it right. Once at least. But at least once put on tefillin. Okay? At least once to avoid this problem. If you're a man, okay? There were women who put on tefillin. There were women. Rashi's granddaughters wore tefillin. Michal used to wear tefillin also. And a woman can do it if she wants, but I wouldn't recommend it. Not our way. Okay. Now, it's a mitzvah that you're not commanded in, although you get reward, but our custom not to do it. Ask somebody knowledgeable before you do such a thing. Now, I mean, it depends on your feminist. You know, there was a girl at Neve Yerushalayim. It was an American girl. Was a very, very, very fiery feminist. This was in the 60s, the late 60s, if I'm not mistaken. A very fiery feminist. And finally, they got to her enough that she was prepared to go to yeshiva. Not enough that she was prepared to go study in Yerushalayim. And so she agreed to go to spend a few months in Neve. So she arrived at Neve Yerushalayim with talis and tefillin. This feminist equals, they're right like anybody else. She arrived with the talis and tefillin. Okay, now. Now, but he has a share in the world to come. To lose your share in the world to come, we're going to discuss that's going to be the next subject and not this evening. All the people who fall into the category of having an overbalancing share of negativity are judged according to everything that they did wrong. That means they'll have to iron out all those things in that dimension. They'll have to suffer the pain of the damage they caused their spiritual bodies, right? And the agony of not having built the body, those two categories like we said. The pain, of course, will regrow those parts of the neshama, but it's painful. But they have a share in the world to come. Shekol Yisrael Yeshlem Chalek Olam Haba. That's a very amazing central belief of Judaism, that every Jew has a share in the world to come. Actually, every person in the world has a share in the final stage of reality, but he's not talking about that here. It has to be understood differently for Jews and non-Jews. I'm not going to go into it now. Even the inanimate world has a place, by the way. It's not only non-Jewish neshamas. Everything will have its place and shine in that dimension with the revelation of what it was supposed to do. Right? Everything, even every blade of grass will show up there as what it was supposed to be. Nothing will be accidentally just kind of here and maybe not, maybe lost. Everything will get there. But now we're talking about Jewish neshamas. Every Jewish neshama has a share in the world to come. Afal pi shechatu, even though he may have sinned, he definitely has a share. Shenema va'amech kulam tzadikim lo'elam yushoaretz. Because your nation is entirely righteous, each one will inherit the land. The land means the higher land, the next world. Eretzu moshel. This, when it says the land, it means the higher land. Kloima, that is to say, Eretz Achaim, the land of the living, or the land of life. Behu olam haba. That's called the next world. V'chein chatzidei umas ro'elam. And similarly, says the Rambam, the righteous non-Jews of the world, yeshlam chalek olam haba. They have a share in the next world, in the same way. But to be a righteous non-Jew, it's a long story also, but very briefly, we're going to leave it here this evening. A righteous, unless there are things that are not clear about this, a righteous non-Jew, chassidei umas ha'olam, although we always like to think of them as people who saved Jews during the Holocaust with their own, risking their own lives. You have many stories of people like that, and they probably do qualify, but the technical qualification for a non-Jew to qualify for a share in the next world, of course he can always convert, right? Although it's difficult. But if he doesn't convert, he lives as a perfect non-Jew should, then the following are the requirements. He has to live, the non-Jew has to live, keeping the seven mitzvahs of the non-Jewish nations perfectly, and they're much harder to keep than ours. I don't know if you're aware of that. We have 613 mitzvahs, they have only seven, but theirs are much harder to keep than ours. They're much more exacting. The tolerances are much narrower. Unlike ours, in Jewish mitzvahs, we have a certain shear, a certain tolerance that you don't really technically transgress until you cover that limit. A non-Jew doesn't have any tolerance at all, even the smallest amount. And the punishments are much more severe for a non-Jew. The earthly punishments for breaking any of his laws are much more severe than they are for a Jew. Right? He only has seven. The death penalty, for example, by Beis Din, when things are run according to Torah lines, for any of the seven, even though a Jew wouldn't get death necessarily for that one of the seven. But he has to keep those seven, and he has to keep them because the Torah says so. That means he has to keep them because if he wants a share in the next world, he has to connect himself to the next world. If he keeps the seven mitzvahs because he thinks they form a nice social system, and he kind of thinks that they make sense anyway, that will not earn him a share in the next world. That will earn him a very happy existence in this world, which is what he wants, and that's fine. If he feels one of the seven mitzvahs for a non-Jew is that he's not allowed to tear the limb off an animal while it's alive. Okay? Eivah min ha-chai. He's not allowed to cut off a limb of an animal, which was a fashion. Some people still do it because it tastes better that way. Look, if there are people who can take creatures and drop them into boiling water and hear them scream, right, because they taste better that way, that's, yeah, so then I wouldn't put it past them to pull legs off frogs or whatever it is that they do. But that's what they do. Anyway, that's Eivah min ha-chai. If he does, if he avoids those things because he thinks it doesn't sound nice, and he keeps all the other laws, not committing adultery, not stealing, not murdering, etc., because they form a nice social system, so he's right about that, but it won't earn him a share in the next world. Just like a Jew, by the way, who wants a share in the next world has to do mitzvahs in a transcendent way. If he wants to have a higher existence, he has to reach a higher level. Not good enough just doing technical acts and expecting to live at a higher plane. Obviously, it takes a meditational and spiritual effort. So a non-Jew has to do that also. He has to connect himself to the correct source and act out what that source demands of him. Then he has a share in what's called umas ha'olam. I'll tell you a story to finish with. A true story about a man, I don't know how long ago, I must have told you this, maybe a couple of years ago, I don't know, who's been here since then. But I'll share with you just to leave you with a thought about a goy who probably reached this level. That is a story I heard from somebody, he's an American chassid, who actually visits Johannesburg quite often. In fact, he just left about a week ago. And this is his story. This man, unfortunately, some private details that I can't tell you, very, very tragic parts of the story, but I'll tell you what I can tell you, is that this man was born from a mother who was in the ghetto in Warsaw during the Second World War. And when the ghetto was closed off and they were all earmarked for destruction and it was about to happen, she was pregnant at the time, and she had to see a doctor. So she managed to sneak out of the ghetto. I'm telling you the story firsthand. Huh? She managed to sneak out of the ghetto to see a gynecologist, a Polish gynecologist who happened to be a woman, who was a woman from the old Polish aristocracy, who was practicing as a gynecologist, obstetrician, in Warsaw. The woman saw the doctor, and after she examined her and treated her, she said to her, you know, if you go back, I'm talking about a Catholic, old, Polish, intensely Christian, Catholic woman. She said to this Jewish woman, do you know what will happen to you if you go back to the ghetto? So the Jewish woman said, yes, I know what will happen. So she said, look, you can come and stay with me. So the woman said, I can't do that because my husband is still back there. So she said, all right, you can fetch your husband. So she said, but I've got family. So she said, bring your family. So she snuck back into the ghetto, and she told her husband that this Polish doctor had said that they could all go and escape and sneak out and stay with her. And she could also bring her family. So her husband said, I'm not going because I've got my family. So she said, well, look, let's take them also. So they arrived secretly at this Polish lady's house with 13 people. She put them up in her attic. She put them in her attic for 22 months, feeding them. They never left the house. Feeding them and taking away all their waste. Right? For 22 months, including a period when the Gestapo occupied the house. Okay? That's what happened. After that, there was a time when they managed to escape. 22 months it took until there was a time when they could escape, and they managed to escape, they got across the border, and they managed to get to America. Those people. Some details I can't tell you, but they managed to get to America. Many, many years later, just a few years ago, there was a wedding in the family. One of the people who'd been saved, that had a child who'd been saved because of that, had grown up now, many years later, to the time, to the point where that person was getting married. So they decided to bring out this old lady. She's still alive. That is, the family decided, this Hasidic New York family, decided to bring out this old lady to be at that wedding, right? As a tribute, as a token, to honor her, they brought her out. Do you know that at that wedding, there were 200 people descended from the 13 people who she'd saved? Present at that wedding, there were 200 people that were alive in the world, direct descendants from the people, including those 13. At that wedding, they asked this old Polish lady, very old lady by now, they asked her, why did she do it? Why did she risk her life to save a bunch of Jews? So this Catholic lady, this Christian lady, answered as follows. She said, because I read the Bible, and I saw in, she said, I read Genesis, and I saw in Genesis that Abraham had a chance. God, he negotiated with God to save the town of Stone. He said to God, if there are 40 righteous people, will you save the town? And God said yes. If there are 30, if there are 10 people, will you save? So she said, she saw that Abraham was able to negotiate with God, that if there would be enough righteous people, he would save the town. She said, I hope there would be enough of us to save Poland. And there weren't. But she said, all right, let's leave it there.